back, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us today for the very first episode of a brand new year, 2021. Welcome back to FLAG. We'll be joined shortly by my good friends, Aaron Lopez and Stephen Snow. As you know, the FLAG calls will be at the forefront of all of compounding related issues. Today's episode is a very special episode. We'll be discussing the recent PBM lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court that I'm sure you're all familiar with, but maybe not the way you think. And as you can see, we're in a new format. So we're trying out a few new things. So make sure to follow Madisca on LinkedIn and on Facebook to make sure you can find us there. We'll be coming to you from multiple different channels instead of the traditional WebEx. Hopefully that'll be easier on you. Let us know.
I'm pretty excited about the new format. I think it's going to allow us to do a lot of great things. I think it's going to allow us to reach more people. You're right. This is a great topic, and this is why we decided to go ahead and dedicate it all to the PBMs. It's something that our industry hasn't really been able to dive deep into, mainly because of their interaction, their cutoff. And I think this is something that we've just found very frustrating. Stephen, I'm glad that you're on the call as well, because you're our legal expert here. Just your initial thoughts on the topic as it comes back up and we're able to discuss it again.
Well, absolutely. This is a very interesting and to put it in maybe hyperbole, exciting ruling from the Supreme Court. Is an 8-0 decision. And you don't always get those these days with the way the court's configured and our political climate in the world these days. And this is an 8-0 decision that really, in certain ways, struck a blow to PBMs and the way that they're currently doing business. And it creates some opportunities for pharmacies on the state level to kind of push back a little bit and to make sure that they're being compensated fairly.
You know, this isn't a specific compounding issue, but it is certainly an independent pharmacy issue. And compounders are all independent pharmacists. I understand that many of them are cash only, but the majority have some component of retail pharmacy. And independent is greatly going to be affected by this decision, I think.
Well, and Philip, to your point, I think that a cash only system kind of precludes several or access to many people. And this is why we're bringing it up again. And we understand that there's been a move to it, but there are some patients out there that for whatever reason, they don't live in a cash only existence and they want to see their insurance pay for it. They will have faith, a little bit more faith when their insurance does pay for it. But I think to Stephen's point also, that this is a regulatory issue, an 8-0 decision, which was great for us. I don't think any of us saw that coming, but also just good to see. And as somebody who's been working with legislation for quite some time, just to see it when the little guy gets a push from the government, as we did with this. I'll tell you, when I entered into the industry, I was really surprised to see the amount of money going into a PBM, and yet they were not regulated, to be able to see that they went from state to state to state. And I, mind you, I worked in the insurance world for many years, have been involved in the insurance world all my life through my father and the companies, the insurance companies that he worked for. And so when I first heard about this, I haven't been from California, I called up the insurance commissioner in California and said, who regulates these guys? And they go, well, if we really want to do it, we have to go through Aetna. We have to go through these other companies to actually get to the PBM. Well, how is that, feasible, and how is that? So part of this episode, we really wanted to go to an expert and, Philip, I'm going to let you introduce him, but I want to introduce Ohio first, only because of their media. And we've talked about them being able to push tweets out through the Ohio Pharmacists Association. They do a great job. And if you don't follow them, I really suggest you do. I follow them fairly religiously because they push out a lot of information. And Philip has some incredible relationships. So why don't you go ahead and introduce our special guest a little bit and why he's so special.
Yeah, we have a fantastic interview that we're going to play, interview with my friend Antonio Chacha from here in Ohio, the great state of Ohio, where we met when he was the government affairs lead there at the OPA, the Ohio Pharmacists Association. And like Aaron said, OPA, Ernie Boyd, the director there, have been doing fantastic work in this area, specifically around PBMs and around spread pricing that's been discovered. And all of that traces back to Antonio's work. So I'm really excited for you guys to meet him and follow him and find him, because the work that he's doing in Ohio, the work that now he's doing with APHA is transformative.
Introduction.
So Antonio, welcome to FLAG. It's really great to see you again.
Great to be here. Great to be here.
Now, are you in Ohio now, or have you moved from?
I'm staying in Ohio. DC does not suit me.
I understand. Great place to visit. So I really would love to start with you. You know, obviously I went through some of your highlights from your resume, and I think it's fair to say you have an interest in PBMs and the way pharmaceuticals are reimbursed. So where did this stem from?
Yeah, I'm borderline obsessed. And a lot of that comes from being born and raised in a pharmacy household. My dad has been a hospital pharmacist for about almost 40 years. And he worked at an independent pharmacy on the side. I originally started to go follow in his footsteps. So I worked as a pharmacy technician at Mark's Pharmacy, which is a small grocery chain up in Cleveland, Ohio, and started pharmacy school at Ohio State. About 2 years in, right around organic chemistry time, I said, this sucks, I'm out of here. And so I switched over to journalism and political science and made my way back to pharmacy over at the Ohio Pharmacists Association back in, that was 2010 when I started there.
The Supreme Court of the United States discussion.
So the SCOTUS decision, can you give me just an overview of Rutledge versus Pharmaceutical Care Management Association? Who is that? And what does this mean for independent pharmacies?
So Rutledge is Leslie Rutledge, the attorney general in the state of Arkansas. In Arkansas, they passed a number of pieces of legislation, but specifically one that addressed a number of issues, including spread pricing, as well as a requirement that PBMs pay a pharmacy no less than their acquisition costs for the drugs that they purchase. I could get into a number of nuances of that law, some of which will bore everyone to death. But the fundamental premise was that a state made a decision to regulate how pharmaceuticals are distributed and paid for in their state. And PCMA, the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, which is the trade association representing pharmacy benefit managers, they had obviously an issue with that. PBMs are heavily reliant on their subjective ability to set rates of reimbursement. The ability to control price is a fundamental to the PBM business model. And so having a state come in and force their hand to some degree on how prices are set was something that was very dissatisfactory to them. So through their trade association, they sued the state. And that case went through a number of layers of the judicial system and eventually made its way over to the Supreme Court. What the PBMs were arguing was that the ERISA, which is essentially a federal law that governs self-funded or employer plans, which traditionally has been a no man's land from a regulatory standpoint. And so the PBMs were arguing that the ERISA laws preempted the state's ability to regulate how they conduct themselves within ERISA plans. So that was the fundamental issue that was laid before the Supreme Court. I'll be honest, I was pessimistic. I did not think that the court would rule in Rutledge's favor, not because of anything that I know legally, not because of anything in the law, but just because I have been primed and learned over the last decade plus not to be optimistic in the functionality of government, especially in the prescription drug world. But lo and behold, we did get a surprise.
State regulations of PBMs.
To what extent now can states regulate? Like, what does this mean? To what extent are they able to regulate the PBM in Arkansas now?
You know, some of the news reports that I've seen out of pharmacy groups and others have characterized this as kind of the floodgates are open. I wouldn't necessarily say the floodgates are open, but, you know, the gates are open. You know, there are still nuances to ERISA where, you know, there are going to be certain protections. However, what this really does do is it marks territory and it says, you know, look, not to bring this back to, you know, our old history in American government classes, but, you know, we were taught that the United States was, you know, willing states coming together to form a federal government and that the states retained a significant amount of autonomy to determine their own fates, labs of democracy. And, you know, the prescription drug industry is highly and heavily regulated from top to bottom. Drug makers, wholesalers, pharmacies, insurance companies. The idea that this heavily regulated industry, that in smack dab in the middle, these multi-billion dollar companies would somehow be able to escape that tangled web of regulatory burden is obviously just... George Washington and Thomas Jefferson didn't sit around and say, states should have the ability to control their own destinies, except when it comes to pharmaceutical middlemen. That's where we draw the line. So, right. You know, if you look at it through that lens, the outcome of the case made a ton of sense. And so, yes, now states can exert some control and, you know, ensure that they can rein in the primary driver of what the end payer pays.
Why Arkansas?
And so why Arkansas? Did they do anything certain? It's different. Were they just the right one at the right time? Was there anything special about this case?
Well, advocacy in general is definitely, you know, right place, right time. You know, you have to, you know, look, I could light a match outside right now. It's not going to light anything. but you know, you light it around some dry tinder, you're going to catch a big flame. So, you know, there have been states that have given it the old college try, but they've never really had everything lined up. You know, Arkansas is a very strong pharmacy state. They have a very formidable state association. Their pharmacists on the ground are not passive. They are very active. They are involved. And they have a state government that I think reflects some of that as well. You have lawmakers that are very responsive. Pharmacists are much more, I don't want to say powerful is a horrible word, but they're far more considered. They are more top of mind in Arkansas than they are in other states. And they happen to have an attorney general who was pissed off. They have, you know, they have state senators and insurance commissioners who all understand that, that look, PBMs aren't an inherent problem, but they are a mechanism that has gone awry that needed to be reined in. And it had the fortitude to go through and fight the status quo. So definitely right place, definitely right time. And I think it's the right moment as well.
Arkansas as a template.
Do you think that Arkansas and Iowa as well, we'll throw them in, do they establish good templates for other states to follow? Are there tweaks that you would love to see? Now that we've seen this law go into effect, some additional things that you would want to change?
Yeah, I think, look, I approach this at a very simplified level. I have a part of the reason that we've been able to do the things we do is I specialize in asking dumb questions and approaching things through the stupid lens. And when I started looking at the problems that pharmacists were explaining to me, I couldn't believe that employers that were paying for this stuff would be okay with this. And so at a very fundamental level, you have a pharmacist that, whether right or wrong, thinks that they should be paid more for what they do. And on the other end of the transaction, you have an employer, whether they're right or wrong, who think that they should be paying less for that. And my problem with the system is that those two entities can't actually make themselves make each other happy. And in fact, there's a growing divide between them. And so I would like to see regulatory reforms that empower that plan sponsor, empower that employer to get creative, to do things differently, to direct contract. We all know that pharmacists can do so much more than fill the prescriptions, except the contracts that are facilitated through the PBMs to back to the plan sponsor are primarily based on cheap drugs. We could argue whether or not they're cheap, but we need to be talking about how pharmacy can be deployed in a more holistic sense to actually get us what we want as a result of the dispensing of drugs, which is better health outcomes. And right now, I think the current system stands in the way of that. So I would love to see regulatory reforms that require exceeding amounts of transparency in the transaction so that plan sponsors are equipped with enough information to start moving around barricades that prevent plan sponsors from getting a better deal when trying to achieve greater health outcomes for their employees.
The importance of advocates.
How important is it for these independent pharmacy owners to be advocates and compounding pharmacy owners as well, of course?
It's everything. It is absolutely everything. PBMs many years ago were hired to be claims processors. They were hired by insurance companies to facilitate transactions for pharmacy claims. Today, those same companies have grown to the size where they are buying the very insurance companies that were hiring them in the first place. These are Fortune 15 companies, okay? And they're not the only problem in the supply chain, but they just happen to be the one that we're talking about today. If you are Joe's Pharmacy or Jane's Pharmacy in small town, whatever, you are not going to beat them on your own. And you will be lucky if all of your pharmacy colleagues combined can essentially help create a better system. To me, this is not about pharmacy, quote, winning. This is about creating a better system of governance for how we facilitate pharmaceutical care in our country. Pharmacists are a huge component of that, and they have to be part of that. I will rant mildly here. But, you know, I started in at the Ohio Pharmacists Association in 2010, and we're by no means the best state association that there is, but we did really damn good work over that decade and that I was there. And join rates amongst the profession are ridiculous. You have about 17% of the profession joining their state associations. We were lucky in Ohio. We actually had a higher membership rate than most state organizations do. If you look nationally, about a third of pharmacists belong to anything. Your entire profession is controlled by government, and the organizations who are charged with actually advocating on your behalf within government are fighting with both arms behind their backs. Advocacy is a bare minimum ask. Involvement is a bare minimum ask. And if anything, I think pharmacists should consider it a professional obligation to be involved in shaping the profession with which they practice.
A great advocacy story.
Our provider status bill in Ohio, weird coincidence. It was my dad going to a coffee hour to go sit down with his state representative. As he was sitting there waiting to go talk with a state representative, some guy walks in and starts talking to him. He didn't know this. It was his state senator. And he starts talking to him about why pharmacists need to be paid for services. And before you know it, by the end of the conversation, Senator Matt Dolan said, "Hey, you know what? I want to work on this. And so screw the state rep. Let's go to my place and talk about how we fix this." And we passed provider status.
D.0.
It was 10 years ago that compounding was reimbursed based on AWP, but it was reimbursed based on a single API, a single pharmaceutical ingredient that was being reimbursed, which in order to cover the costs, you know, ultimately inflated the AWP pricing because they needed to be paid. That needed to encompass all the other ingredients and the work that went into compounding. And it was fine. The system worked. And then NCPDP launched their D.0. Where now reimbursement, and I know I'm way in the weeds here, but the reimbursement, like you, I'm a nerd for these things. So reimbursement now went to each individual ingredient. They wanted to capture everything that was going into these compounds. But then at the same time, they started to reimburse for everything that was going into these compounds. And that was based off of already, you know, what would have been probably inflated AWPs that used to cover the entire cost. So now you have a situation where the total cost of compounds was inflated a lot, which caused a lot of people to come into this industry that weren't in this industry prior, take advantage of situations that were being done. Obviously, that then ultimately resulted in the draconian stopping of coverage, essentially. Mm-hmm. There are still some here and there.
A hope for compounding and PBMs?
But I'm curious. You know, obviously, there's a place for compounding and there's a need for compounding and there's a need for it to be democratized. The way I see compounding right now, it's very much for those who are able to pay for it. It's not reaching those that need it. It's not reaching the patient populations that could be utilizing, say, topical pain instead of utilizing opioids or what have you, or utilizing all of these therapies that they might need. So I'd love to sort of just pick your brain. What would compounding need to do? How would they create? You mentioned looking at PBMs and looking at the future of PBMs and focusing on health outcomes, for instance. Is that something that would be of interest to PBMs if the industry were able to provide health outcomes data for compounds? Would they even care? Is there something else that you can think of that would, where compounding could be more of an accepted practice within the PBMs and reimbursement world?
So in today's world, I would have a very pessimistic view about PBMs, you know, coming around to compounding, because PBMs don't have incentives aligned in the outcome of the patient. We all know that compounds in personalized medicine can go a long way to making patients better. But they are, you know, cost prohibitive relative to other drugs that are typically available in the marketplace. That's excluding, obviously, a lot of the new high-priced biologics that are coming to market, yada, yada. And because PBMs can't shake down a manufacturer for big, cushy rebates on compounded drugs, they lack any financial incentive really whatsoever to cover them in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend, you know, bringing the case directly to the payer. You know, and part of the reason that I'm very excited about what provider status opens up, and I'm very excited about the opportunity in Ohio, is because if I rewind the tape, when I had a problem with a pharmacy getting paid, you know, too little, I was bringing those complaints to a PBM where obviously they died. And then we'd go back to the health plan, and the health plan would say, that's the PBM. And so this, like, weird chasing your tail continues, you know, in perpetuity. By throwing excessive mud on the tires of PBMs for doing wrongdoings in our state, we were able to capture the attention of the managed care plans, and they at least had to start returning phone calls rather than simply just passing us off. With the passage of provider status, we got to take that one step further. And now, rather than the managed care plans passing me off to the PBM, today we're having conversations about, hey, how can pharmacists actually make your patients better? Or more importantly, managed care plan, what are your priorities? What do you care about? What incentives do you have? What metrics are you trying to achieve? Then we're taking that and overlapping it with, essentially, we're creating a Venn diagram, if you will, of pharmacist services that can actually help achieve those outcomes and those goals. And now we're having direct relationships and conversations with the insurance companies. And again, insurance companies are not necessarily, you know, saints by any stretch, but I'll take my chances with the incentives of the insurance industry than I will the incentives of the PBM industry. And so if there is a compelling story to tell on how personalized medicine and compounded products can make patients better, or overall disease management with compounding pharmacies relative to the rest of the marketplace, if there is a value proposition to the plan that, again, overlaps with their incentive design, now you have a recipe for success. Now you have something where you what you want is the same as what they want. And now you can actually start actually making some progress and headway in creating a better system of alignment. To me, that's how compounding really stakes its territory more longitudinally, at least in the insurance marketplace.
What to expect in the future?
Is the PBM going to change in any meaningful way in the next 5 to 10 years? Is it better? Is it worse for independent pharmacies? Where do you think the winds are blowing here?
I think there's going to be a slog. I think independent pharmacies are probably going to have a difficult couple of years. I don't think it'll be more difficult, or at least significantly more, but I think they're going to have to hold their nose for a little bit. You know, I think that state regulators and federal regulators are finally coming around. The problem is that it's very slow, very slow. And I also think that, you know, the opportunities on provider status represent, you know, an opportunity that could really take us out of the doldrums of the current trajectory. If the system is allowed on its current autopilot, I have no optimism for independent pharmacy. But I don't see the system continuing on autopilot. Not if we have anything to say about it. And I also believe that even if we don't, if we didn't exist, there, I think there's enough momentum now that change is going to happen. I think pharmacies need to be creative. I need to be more more business savvy. A lot of the pharmacies that close are certainly as a result of headwinds from the current industry, but it's also self-imposed headwinds of not evolving and not changing and not adapting. One of my biggest fears is that when you suffocate something so much and you put businesses in a position of desperation, there are ways to be clever and unique. And there are ways that I think that you can blur the lines of ethics to keep your businesses afloat, which we have seen, you know, a few times in the pharmacy world.
That was a great discussion. I'm not going to say interview, because I think the way that you can see, you know, him, the passion and his desire to go ahead and help the industry, help independent pharmacists. What we heard, you know, with his family being in it, with his father and his father being involved in it, you know, and him starting to go the same route. You can see that there, and that he wanted to do better for the industry. And I think that's one of the greatest things in this industry is the passion from the pharmacists, from those that support it, from those that work in it, and from the supply aspect of it, just everybody that wants to see this industry grow.
Absolutely. I mean, when he talks about advocacy, you know, it really speaks to me. It's the same idea that I have. You know, you have to use your voice. You know, I spent so long going around saying, someone needs to do this, someone needs to do this, someone needs to do this. And there comes a point when we all have to sort of do it. We realize that it's actually on us. Somebody else isn't going to do it. And if they do, they're the ones that set the rules. So I really loved, especially that portion about the advocacy and the passion that Antonio has.
I agree. I think that's one of the major takeaways for me of that interview, that discussion, was the need for advocacy. And a lot of times the challenge that we feel and people in the industry feel with getting involved is there's so much inertia to overcome, right? I'm one person, I'm one pharmacy, I've got maybe a small group with me, and we're pushing against this huge opposition force. This ruling by the Supreme Court has created immediate momentum that if across the country, independent pharmacists will get together and go and advocate for their profession and push their local legislators to get in the game on this. I mean, this is an issue that I can't imagine any state legislator not wanting to get behind and help small businesses and help put together similar code provisions and statutes on a state level that mirrors what's already been drafted and already been found 8-0 constitutional by the Supreme Court. There's no easier bill to draft now than taking and erasing Arkansas off the top and putting Georgia or Louisiana or Texas on it. I mean, that's kind of, I mean, they've given you the roadmap. They've given you something that does work. Get behind it, put your name on it, and with enough constituents pressing to do it, we've got momentum here that people can really springboard off of and make an impact.
Well, Stephen, and I tell you, I love the story that he was telling of his father. He was sitting there with one legislator, and another legislator happened to come in. He found out and goes, hey, that sounds great. I mean, when we meet with legislators on the Hill, a lot of them tell us, you have such a great story. And I think you're right. I think a decision like this will give states the push that they need to move forward with it. So once again, Philip, I think that was a great job. You know, there are states all over the country that are getting involved, that, you know, are in desperate need of support in the associations and at the legislative levels and with the boards of pharmacy. So I really enjoyed that discussion. I think it's, you know, we were discussing, you know, a few days ago, just the importance it is to support the association. So, you know, he's with APHA now, and he's doing double duty. I just got a text from him, or not a text, a tweet, you know, just today, him pushing it out from the OPA, so from the Ohio. So you can see he's still working at the Ohio level, and he's working at the federal level for it. And you'll have, Philip, you have to tell me his title again. I just want to say disruptor. That's the only thing that comes to mind. It's an incredible title that he has.
Professional agitator.
Yeah, that's right.
Basically, of PBMs. He's the senior advisor for disruptive innovation and practice transformation. It's a great title. Yeah.
That
I'm envious.
Is a great title. Yeah. You know, I think it's like one of those Supreme Allied Commander type titles.
There you go. I know that we are a compounding, you know, FLAG is specifically, we talk about compounding. And I know that we may have a lot of viewers who are cash businesses. They're cash pharmacies. And they're saying, you know, that this, you know, maybe doesn't apply to them. Well, maybe it doesn't. But number one, it applies to your profession and to your fellow pharmacists. And I really wanted to talk a little bit about the compounding and PBMs, you know, that I was very interested in finding out what the future is. To me, I feel like a lot comes with it. I feel like it's fine to have a cash business. I think that that's fine, that that's your choice, but I think it should be a choice. I also think that with PBMs comes legitimacy for our industry. It makes it more legitimate. It's recognized as having therapeutic outcomes. And that whole conversation about outcomes, I mean, that completely aligns with my thoughts of the next 5 years of compounding. You know, if we can start to show outcomes, we can start to show the benefit, not just in of one individual, but of one individual times 1,000 that we've been treating, you know, and if we can start to show how that translates into dollar signs for these major medical payers. And I'd never really thought about going directly to major medical, which was fascinating to me because, again, the incentives align. It makes perfect sense. I mean, what Antonio's saying makes a lot of sense. You know, they're the ones that you're trying to reduce the spend. You're trying to say, you know, by utilizing these hormone replacement therapy for postmenopausal women, we're reducing the burden of the health, you know, by reducing, you know, the hospitalizations even. You know, you can even talk about psychiatric care that I've heard people tell stories of that have been curbed through use of bioidentic hormone replacement therapies. You can talk about pain management and the reduction of opioid utilization in the system that it would benefit from. So there are so many ways that we could do it if we can start to create data, I guess.
Well, and Philip, I'll tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed that discussion when he's talked about it. And when he said go directly to the payers, there was something inside that clicked because, you know, to a PBM, their job is to go ahead and take care of the drug pricing aspect of it. They're not interested on how many times a person goes back and forth to a doctor. That's not their billing. They don't care how many times a patient goes back and forth to the hospital. That's not their billing. That's not their primary cost. Whereas a pharmacist, especially a compounding pharmacy, to bring it back into this discussion, their whole goal is to make you whole again. And I've never seen an industry where their whole desire is for you to stop using their services. And but that's what it is. You know, we want to get you better and we want to get you to stop. And I think that discussion was right. If we can take that kind of a case network or case discussion to the payers and say, hey, look, this is what we're trying to do. This is what we want. You know, we don't want hospital recidivism. You know, we want you to go ahead and, you know, take care of the patient. And this is how we want to do that. So I enjoyed that part of the discussion.
Yeah. And, you know, I think all of our compounders who have dealt with the headache of PBMs have stories like this. But I remember one compounder explaining to me that they went back and forth with the PBM to get coverage for something for like diabetic neuropathy. It was something for like a foot. And going back and forth and telling this PBM, like, look, this is the only thing keeping them from amputating. Like, if this isn't working, they will amputate. And the PBM's response was, well, that will go on major medical. Like, that's the like mindset of some of the, not all of them. I don't want to paint everyone here, but that is the mindset as far as the incentives go. You know, that doesn't go back to them, that goes on somebody else. So if we can align on a more longitudinal basis and show the benefit, you know, and again, to me, that's the great democratizer. Right now, a lot of compounds are for people who can afford them, who can afford to pay that fee for the customized medication, which, don't get me wrong, many, many times is absolutely worth it. But if you simply can't afford it, you simply can't afford it. Yeah. So to me, getting healthcare into the hands of the individuals who need it is key. It doesn't mean every practice should have to take insurance or deal with that headache. And if you're in an area that supports that, that's wonderful. And I applaud you and you're probably doing amazing work. But I would love to see the compounding reach more patients who need it.
You know, like Antonio mentioned, we live in a capitalistic society and we want to incentivize these drug manufacturers to continue coming out with the next latest and greatest medication. And that's why PBMs are important. They have a very critical role to play in keeping those prices manageable where they can spread across, like you said, the democratization of medicine. We've got to figure out a way to work with PBMs better. And this Supreme Court ruling helps balance the playing field a little bit better and makes it possible to be on the same page with PBMs and know that those pharmacies that are providing these drugs will at least break even. I mean, is that doesn't seem to be too much to ask. It's at least let us break even. We don't need to make a ton of money like PBMs you are, but you know, we're on the front lines treating these patients. We should not do it at a loss because of your spread pricing and great profits. So.
Well, once again, Philip, it was an incredible discussion. We appreciate you taking the time to sit down with Antonio, and one of the miracles of the technology that we have was we're able to reach across. And I know he's still in Ohio, but still the ability to go ahead and have some of these. And so hopefully we'll be able to bring more of these in the future for it. I also want to bring up that being the new year, things you should look out for, what is legislative sessions are starting to heat up. And hopefully in our next discussion that we'll be able to go ahead and pinpoint some of the legislation that's coming up around the country at the state level so that we can get involved. Stephen, I'm guessing that your program that you're heading up around the states and the ambassador program that you've got going, that's heating up as well.
It is as well, and I anticipate this PBM issue kind of feeding into that as well, as we get people out talking to their legislators and saying, hey, this could happen in our state too. And I think we got a lot of opportunities out there this year. 2021 is going to be another big year.
And Philip, correct me if I'm wrong, but being a new year, I think we have EDUCON coming up as well. I think APC, this is you should start seeing the little bit of the advertisements from them coming out.
Yeah, that's out there as well. So make sure to look at EDUCON. It's going to be a wonderful program. I do want to also give a special thanks to APHA for loaning us, Antonio, for the call, obviously, as well as Medisca for doing everything that they do for us here.
So you're saying Antonio's only on loan, that we can't co-opt him.
And we borrow him at OPA too, and we borrow him.
Exactly.
So, and he has two different companies he's with. So he's a little busy.
Yeah. But. Well, like I said, I would have gone on hours on just the gray market alone on some of the work that he's doing to help curb those aspects of it. So
same. I want to talk to him about gray market and HCG. So we'll find a way to talk about that next.
Yeah. little foreshadowing of future episodes to come.
I'd love to pick his brain there, but absolutely. And please reach out. Let us know if you enjoyed this episode, if you enjoyed the interview, if you have questions, if there are things you'd love us to follow up on or recap, please reach out. We'll, depending on what platform that you're seeing this on, hopefully there's a link below us where you can actually send us a email here.
Stephen, Philip, with that, thank you very much. Welcome to the new year, 2021. It's already started off with quite a bang. Hopefully bigger and better things to come forward for the rest of the year. I hope you and your families are well, and thank you guys very much.
Have a great day, you guys. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, everyone.